Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book, In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 8.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to The Story Behind the Song, the podcast where we interview the most iconic artists behind the most iconic songs of the past few decades. I'm your host, Peter Chatti, and I'll go deep with your favorite musicians to learn about their fascinating creative journeys into how their most popular and lasting songs came to be. We'll also discuss one of the artist's favorite deep cuts from their own catalog. And in the process, these icons will reveal their own personal experiences through the years and their candid reflections about their triumphs and challenges. Let me introduce today, and it's wonderful to have Colin Hay, who's a singer, songwriter, musician, actor. We'll talk about that a little bit too. Yes. Of the iconic band Men at Work, of course. Colin led the band through the early 80s and three studio albums, and since then has had a very successful solo career with multiple albums and a new album upcoming that we'll talk about. And I also want to mention that his songs have been featured in multiple soundtracks, of course, including one of my favorites, the indie soundtrack Garden State, where his solo song, I Just Don't Think I'll Ever Get Over You, was featured, which is a beautiful song. And I was just watching a clip earlier today of Colin on The Larry Sanders Show with Gary Shandling, which was one of my favorites that you can find on HBO Max. So all kinds of things, Colin. And today we're going to talk about the song Down Under, of course, from Men at Work's 1981 breakthrough album Business as Usual. And then Colin identified his favorite song being Waiting for My Real Life to Begin, which was first released on his 1994 solo album, Topanga, and then later released in a very different form, in an acoustic version, in his 2001 album, Going Somewhere. So enough of the introductions. Colin, welcome to The Story Behind the Song.
Nice to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you. Where are you calling in, or where are you joining me from today?
I live in Topanga, California.
Okay.
I've been here for about 30 years. Actually, 30 years last month. I lived in the same place.
Ah, and
I think May 91. I came here with the old band in the early 80s, but I lived in Melbourne and Australia up until I really came here in 89 because I had a record deal. And then I went back to Melbourne, and then I realized that I really wanted to be here. So I came back here, and I've been here ever since.
What was it ultimately that led you from leaving Australia to come to Los Angeles?
There were multiple reasons why I came here. One reason was that I had a record deal with MCA Records, which I was on Columbia, which was a deal out of New York, and the then head of Columbia got the sack, and he moved to MCA Records in Los Angeles and offered me a deal. It was a very short-lived deal. I was supposed to do two albums, but only did one, and then they dropped me. But that's why I came here initially. That was one reason I came here, was because I had a record deal which was based in Los Angeles. Another reason was I was getting divorced. And so that was another reason. And then another reason was that I was having trouble with a drink, and all my friends were high-functioning drug addicts and alcoholics. And, you know, they're very successful people, but they just got really out there all the time, and I just couldn't do it anymore. And so I just ran away. I ran away from Melbourne. It's a difficult place to leave because it's a beautiful place to live. And it's one of the great cities of the world. But when I came to Los Angeles, which is perhaps an odd thing to find, but I found it a very, strangely, a very spiritual place because nobody really cares about you. You know, you've got about 30 seconds to state your piece and then people just move on or they want to change the channel.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they accept you. They accept you for what you're doing and for who you are. And so I found that very liberating in a way.
Yeah.
And also I was freshly sober, so I didn't have my past around my neck. And so I could start here with a clean slate. So I always associate Los Angeles with starting again and it being kind of more full of light.
Yeah, well, and Topanga is a very spiritual place, part of Los Angeles, despite the fires
raise through. But even driving down the 101, sometimes I can have moments of euphoria.
Oh, absolutely! It's a beautiful drive. It's a wonderful drive. Colin, I would like to understand, because I think it's always interesting for people out there to, you know, how did someone from their youth ultimately become a musician? What was there always an interest in music? At what point did you go that way? Was it accidental? Just take me through that a little bit as a young lad who had moved from Scotland to Australia. And, you know, what led you to ultimately your first music work?
Well, it's in my DNA for a couple of reasons. I think that a lot of people from Scotland are musical, and it comes from, there's a tradition of singing to get into a party, you know, on the weekend, if you're going to go to a party, because that's what you did. And to get into a party, you had to be able to sing. You had to have a party piece. And so that goes way back. That's kind of inbuilt in a way. But my mother and father were both musical. My father was on the stage when he was young. He was a singer and a dancer. And he had a lot of talent. It was unfulfilled in a way. He didn't follow it. He was a child prodigy, they say. He was on very successful when he was 12, 13 years old on the stage in Glasgow in the 1930s. But then the war came. He became a piano tuner, so he was in a related field. But from the years of 1958 until 1967, we had a music shop in Scotland, a record store. So that was an amazing time to be behind the counter. You know, even when I was young, I would help my mother and father on a Saturday, serve in the shop from when I was maybe 8 or 9 years old. Mm. And so I was surrounded by music and amazing music at that time, an astonishing, you know, decade of music from that time, 58 to 67. I mean, my God, that was a golden period, you know. So every Monday you'd get singles that would come in, whether it was You Really Got Me by the Kinks or I Feel Fine or, you know, Green Onions or Jim Reeves or Elvis or Bob Dylan. It was just coming at you all the time. And so from the age of about 13, I really became, I think that it was She Loves You really was the song where I just thought, I was still in Scotland and I went to this dance and She Loves You was playing and it was just, it was so magical. And I just thought, my, this is a world that I want to belong to. And also, you know, I was sitting having a Coca-Cola at the Eglinton Cafe when I was 13 and I heard Good Vibrations. And I thought, well, I want to go where that sound comes from because that's, I don't really understand that. It just sounded otherworldly to me. So I started to take guitar lessons and just basically became obsessed with the Beatles and I took guitar lessons from a girl who lived in a town near me, and she taught me how to play "House of the Rising Sun." And if you know, if you've played "House of the Rising Sun," you know that when you play that song, if there's an F chord in it, where you have to bar two strings.
Mm-hmm.
So once you get past that, you're off and running.
Yeah, yeah, that's tough. I have that challenge as I try to play those things back there. That's for sure. And so. You started at about, you said about the age of 13, 14, picking up the guitar?
Yeah.
Okay.
I played piano before that, but regrettably, I gave it up like a damn fool. My father and mother said, got me good piano lessons, and I was okay at it. I was pretty good, actually, but I had a good memory, so I would sight read to the point where I could remember the tunes, and then I would just do them from memory, and I got caught out doing that. But I think I was probably just lazy. I wanted to go and play football in the street or up in the park with my friends. And it's my big regret, actually. I really regret not continuing with the piano.
Well, there's still plenty of time, and you've done all right with guitar.
Well, I've got the book, Piano for the Older Beginner, and I'm working through that.
Ah, there you go. Outstanding. So when did you write your first song?
When I was about 14, I was in Australia, and I used to play at this folk club called Balmorris Folk Club, which is the town that I lived in when I first went there. I can't remember what the song was. I've tried to remember, but I can't.
So you were already playing a folk club at that age?
Yeah, I was playing from when I was 14 years old.
Huh.
And it was a great breeding ground, because they used to have really great folk artists that would come through and play. So I learned a lot. You know, one guy had a Martin guitar. I think his name was Peter Martin, actually. but he played fingerstyle.
Yeah.
And then there was a guy that would come in, and name of Danny Spooner. He came in and he had a little harmonium pump organ, you know, and just these great sounds that you probably wouldn't have heard in other places. So that kind of music, you know, came to me, which was quite strange, because it was a, you know, very leafy kind of middle class suburb which was the last place you'd expect to hear, you know, relatively hardcore folk music, you know, being played at that time.
Right.
So it was really great.
And so your songwriting began right around that time.
Yeah.
Do you remember your first song?
No, I was just saying, I can't remember it.
Oh, you can't remember it, okay.
No, I've tried to remember it, but I can't remember what it was. But I wrote songs a lot, you know, from that point on. And, I mean, maybe some of them were okay. I actually played a show in Melbourne a few years ago, and the drummer of my first band came, and we were talking, and he said, he said, "Do you remember?" He said, "We used to play your songs." And I said, "No, I don't remember that." He said, "Oh, yeah, we played a lot of your songs." He said, "They were good." I said, "I have no memory of what they were called." And but he said, "Yeah, we played, because we would play covers as well." But we, you know, he said, "No, we used to play quite a few of your songs." And I had no memory of that at all.
Hmm.
So, yeah, you just kind of keep keep writing or banging away at it. And then hopefully eventually, you know, ones start to come through that have a bit of shine to them, you know?
And so then ultimately from those early days, and you were playing in clubs, to the point where you met with, I guess, you tell me where the genesis of Men at Work was, and meeting your partner who helped found the band. And, you know, my understanding was that you started first as a duo together.
Yeah.
So just take me through that a little bit.
Well, I was in a band in 73, and really great musicians, and a drummer. The first musician who really gave me a lot of confidence was a guy called Bones Elliott, Keith Elliott. He passed away a year or two ago, and he was a great drummer and really fantastic feel drummer. And he gave me a lot of confidence, because he said, you know, "Let's put a band together. We'll call it the Colin Hay Band." He says, "Because you've got the songs, and we'll do well." So we tried that for a few months.
And, yeah.
And it didn't work that well. We played a couple of shows and I don't know, it wasn't really happening. But he was very, very positive and gave me a lot of confidence as a songwriter. But
let me ask you a question about that. So in that, were you singing with that band too? So did you always have confidence in your singing because you started at songing?
From when I was about 14,
okay.
I was in a band. The first band was called Deep Impression. And mm-hmm. Our singer got taken away because he'd stolen a PA system from the local school. And the cops came and took him away, so we had no singer. So I had to sing. And then I discovered, oh, this is good.
One of those wonderful twists of fate.
I know. He wasn't a very good criminal because, I mean, the police thought, well, okay, who needs a PA system? There's only two bands in the town, so they went to visit. Ben came to visit us.
That's pretty good.
So anyway, in the back of my mind, I also had, you know, my parents were kind of, you know, I wanted to please my parents because they weren't particularly happy about the fact that I was going to, you know, follow go into a life of music. So I went to university, you know, just to kind of bide my time. I thought, well, okay, this band's not quite working out, so I'll go back to school and just please them, and then that'll give me time to strategize, which actually worked out quite well because I went to university, so they were happy. And they were very, you know, they were kind of very, you know, beautiful people, but, you know, worried about the fact that I was going to become some kind of drug addict, I think, you know.
As parents always are.
Yeah. And so I went to university. And there I met Russell, who became the band's manager. And I'd met Greg through a friend of mine before I went to university. So I knew Greg at school. And Greg wasn't even a musician then. He was just about to take up saxophone and flute, you know, then around 1972. So, and Jerry I met through Kim, my friend Kim as well, the drummer at university. So university was really good because it did give me time to write songs and just to kind of try and figure out how to put this thing together because I wanted to put a band together eventually. So I went through the university and enjoyed it, you know, and you know, got an arts degree, which is basically useless, you know, but I did that. And then I came out the other end and I got this job in a musical called Ned Kelly. But before that, just before I went off to kind of to be in that, I got a job in the chorus of that. I was in this backyard in West Melbourne, and I met I saw this young guy playing playing an Ovation 12-string acoustic guitar, and he was playing beautifully. And I thought, this is really magic. This guy's really got something. So I just listened to him, and I got talking, and we started to chat, and I think we might have played a little bit together. I can't quite remember. But just at that point on, I knew that this was the person that I wanted to write, maybe not even write songs with necessarily, but I knew that I wanted to work with him because he was special. So that was Ron mm-hmm. Stryker, and indeed, mm-hmm. and I said, when I come back from this musical, let's do something together, let's play music together, and so that's what we did, and it was exactly as I hoped and thought it would be. We started to work together and write together and play together. And indeed, this interesting sound came out, which was really the germination of what became Men at Work.
And how did you come up with the name together for the band?
Well, I thought of the name Men at Work because there are signs, the Men at Work signs everywhere, and there's, you know, one guy digging a trench and nine guys watching him, you know. and it struck me as just something that people see all the time when they're driving around. So it would be it's in your peripheral vision or in your consciousness, that road sign. And it was one of a number of names that were in the hat, so to speak. And we had a gig to start playing at the Cricketers Arms Hotel, and the owner of the pub called Joe Taylor called us and said, "Hey, listen, I need to put something on the blackboard. You need to have a name." And so Ron said, "I think we should go with Men at Work." And so that's what we did. So he put Men at Work on this blackboard.
Yeah.
That's how we first started to play. And strangely enough, when he put Men at Work on the blackboard, a few guys came in and applied for work. He thought he was asking for people to go.
Expanding the numbers in the band. Well, it's always interesting. Like, I always love to hear the genesis of the names of bands as well, and just kind of the beginnings of their lives and how it all came to be. And there's so much that we could talk about. I want to focus on the two songs that we mentioned, yeah, because I know that jumps kind of from there to here, but nonetheless, let's first talk about one of Men at Work's biggest hits, and that is the song Down Under. And, you know, that comes from your debut major label album, Business as Usual. And you co-wrote the song, correct, with Ron?
Yes.
Yes. And so tell me the story of that, of how it came to be. You know, one of the things, as I was looking into things a little bit, I did not know this, that it was originally a B-side, that's what, yes, I read, to one of your initial releases that was called Key Punch Operator. But you take me through the whole story of how that came to be and everything of it.
Well, Ron used to give me little cassette tapes of ideas that he had, because he used to do home recordings on a little Porta studio.
Mm-hmm.
And he would give me cassettes to listen to. And one of them had this little hypnotic trance-like groove on it, which was just and it was really intriguing to me, and so I listened to it endlessly in the car, just on, it was, you know, really was like a loop. But and I had a phrase in my head, "Live in the land down under." I had that for a few weeks, and I just started singing that over the top of it. So it would go, "Dun tuka dum buka dun dum, living in the land down under, dun tuka dum buka dun dum." And then I just kept singing that, and I thought that might be something. And I just sang that all the way home, because I lived just out of the city. And then and I got home, and then I just slept, you know, went to sleep, and then the next morning I just woke up and then the wrote the words and the chords and the whole thing came out. The whole song basically came to be the next morning, but it had been triggered by Ron's cassette. So that's how it came about.
You know, look, it's interesting, because I've spoken with several musicians, several great artists, and so many times I hear the reality of they have been sleeping and they wake up to,
yeah, that's right,
be an inspiration to a lyric or melody.
Yeah, it's a powerful thing, sleep, in that regard. It can be a very creative thing I found that to be the case, where you wake up in the morning and the first couple of hours is you can do a lot with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of those, those moments. And I mean, I went to Australia as an immigrant, so I always had this idea of the fact that Australia felt very different under my feet. But I always wanted to write a song somehow about the country that I was, that I'd moved to, you know, and now called home. And so that was the one that I came up with. And it's interesting, because it keeps changing. Meaning as time goes on, you know, it's an interesting song in that regard, you know.
Did it just, when you woke up and you said that you were, you know, you fleshed it out, you wrote the lyrics, did it pour out of you at that time, essentially in one sitting?
Yeah, it was 40 minutes, 40 minutes.
Amazing.
Yeah, 40 minutes is, and I often say to people, you know, would you recommend songwriting as a profession. And I say to them, well, you know, down under, and I think about this a lot. Actually, I think about this most days. So 40 minutes changed my life. I mean, those 40 minutes enabled me to live for the rest of my life. You know, if I'm careful, I mean, that is the case.
Yeah.
So yes, I would recommend it highly. Because you never know.
Exactly. That's right. But write down your ideas when you're inspired like that, because otherwise they have the risk of floating away.
I think you should write down your ideas even when you're not inspired.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Well,
because if you wait for inspiration, sometimes nothing happens. You know, I think inspiration can be practiced.
Mm-hmm. But did you know that when you were inspired like that, you woke up and you wrote it all down within 40 minutes? Did you know immediately that you had something special?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Yeah, and I mean, the interesting line in that song, I mean, I had a lot of fear and trepidation at that time. I mean, I was, a bit of a tree hugger, hippie, if you like. But I was left of center in the sense that I didn't relate with conservative thinking and the way things had been in Australia for so long. And it was an interesting time because things were changing. There was a lot more social consciousness and people were waking up. So I thought. there was a momentous thing that happened in 1975 in Australia where the government, which was a Labour government, which is basically a democratic government, a guy by the name of Gough Whitlam, who I was a big fan of, the government got sacked by the Queen. And so that was a monumentally weird, strange thing to happen because there was a constitutional crisis. And mm-hmm. They didn't know what to do, and so they had to ask the Queen, because the Queen is ostensibly still the Queen of Australia. So she said to the Governor General, "You figure it out." And so he sacked the government. So a democratically elected government was sacked by the Queen.
That's amazing.
So it was horrendous. And so people took to the streets and so forth. So that was a moment for me where I realized I figured out really which side I was on. And I mean, I knew that before that. But so I always had a lot of suspicion of, large corporations and big money and the government. And so the second line of the chorus, which is... where women glow and men plunder, really is what the song is about, really. It's really the fact that women tend not to destroy things, but that seems to be in the realm of men, was really what that was. What I perceived was that Australia, being an incredibly unique place, was being sold down the river for short-term gains, whether it's destroying old growth forests, or whether it's the desecration of coastal lands, or whether it becoming overdeveloped and much along the same lines as a lot of the US. And I just thought, well, this is becoming like everywhere else. And the verses were really, poking fun or taking a satirical look at the stereotypical, rather unconscious Australian traveling overseas who is kind of blissfully unaware of the fact that, 23 million people or something have this huge continent that they've inherited. Mm-hmm. And we should look after it, you know? And so to me, there was a lot of amazing kind of, Australia is a truly awesome place in the true sense of the word. And So many people seem to be unconscious to me about actually just where they were and what we had to do to actually sustain ourselves, Mm-hmm. I mean, that can be seen in lots of ways. I'm blowing my own trumpet by any means, but back in the 70s and the early 80s when we were, trying to get away from the cities, and that's what I was trying to do anyway. I was I always had a love of hills and dales and more pastoral life, if you like. But you know, we could always sense that as far as climate change was concerned, that what we were doing was unsustainable, you know, and Australia has always had problems with things like bushfires and stuff like that. But now the evidence and the of climate change is really apparent there. Whether it's a fire, if a fire comes through, it's a super fire.
Yeah.
If there's a flood, it's a super flood. If it's a drought, it's a really dry drought for many for much longer. And so it's everything is much more extreme, you know. So anyway, I think that, you know, thinking about the song, it's ultimately, I think, a song about celebration. But not really, you know, in a flag waving way, which a lot of people, you know, took it as.
Yeah.
But it's really a song ultimately about celebration and connection, because I know that because when I play it in Bolivia and they have the same, you know, they have the same response to it that they do in Australia, or yeah. Play it in some far off land that has no idea what the lyrical content is, but they just know it makes them feel good.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because I would imagine very few people who are listening to this would understand that song had these kind of political undertones that you were talking about just now, about men plundering and women glowing.
Yeah, it was just really that we're going to have to reap what we'll probably at some point have to reap what we sow.
Right.
You know, which is really, I think, what is indeed happening.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an amazing place. It really is still. I mean, and oddly enough, I say the founding of Australia, but you know, when white people first went to Australia, which was just in the late 1700s, I think Aboriginals, you know, the time keeps on getting changed, but, you know, Indigenous people had been living there, they said, for 30,000 years and 40,000, 50,000, 60,000, and now, you know, maybe even more than that, but, you know, maybe 80,000 years Indigenous people have been living in that on that continent, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been there for a minute in comparative terms. But, you know, it's all tied in with the American Revolution, because when America became a country, Americans said to Britain, right, off you go home. This is our country now. And so told the British to go home. And indeed they did. And they said, by the way, you know, you can keep your convicts as well. We don't want any more of your convicts, because Britain had been sending convicts to America.
Mm-hmm.
To get, you know, to serve out their term, because they didn't have any space in jails. And so when America said, you can't, you know, don't send your convicts here anymore, they had nowhere to send them. So that's how Australia was actually first. They said, oh, well, we'll need to send them somewhere. So they started sending them to Australia. So the founding of Australia by white people is really closely tied in with the American Revolution.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting. When you think about all of that and the song itself and how you immediately felt like you had something, you had captured magic in the bottle, essentially, you know, lightning had struck you with inspiration. How did that song then become the B-side to one of your early releases, Key Punch Operator?
Well, Down Under predated Men at Work. Ron and I, we used to play it as an acoustic duo, and it was more meandering. It was a bit more, it was less focused. Everything was there, you know, all the words were there and the chords were there and everything, but it was more meandering and, you know, less of a pop song, if you like.
Yeah.
And when Men at Work formed, that kind of continued in a way. We were a bit more of a jam band. You know, we would play live and we would play these songs and explore ideas, and we would take them places that perhaps, you know, you're going down a main road with a song, and sometimes you think, oh, we'll take this side road, we'll see what's down here, and you explore it for a while. And I think that Down Under, when we first recorded it, first of all, we went into the studio and we didn't really know what we were doing. We went in with a couple of, an engineer, and nobody was really particularly experienced. I think Jerry had made a record before that. But in the studio, we didn't really know what we were doing. And so it didn't end up sounding particularly good.
Mm-hmm. Is there any place to find that original recording?
Oh, I think you can get it. There, it's around, you know, somewhere. I don't have a copy. Maybe I've got a copy somewhere, but, you know, my God, I don't know where to start to try and look for it. You know,
yeah.
It could be in a number of places.
But, it'd be fascinating to listen to, actually.
But the thing that was really a turning point for us was we started to play live, and we started to develop the songs, and we started to develop a really, really strong live following. And the songs were apparent. I mean, even if the songs were, say, Who Can It Be Now, when we first used to play, it was 6 minutes long, you know. And the saxophone hook of the song, it never used to come in until halfway through the song. So that's okay when you're playing live, because nobody cares, because people are drinking and they're just trying to, you know, they're trying to pull women or whatever they're trying to do, you know. And you're playing these live songs. So this record producer came along. An A&R guy from CBS Records, which became Sony, but at that time it was CBS, came down to see the band, and he brought this American record producer, a guy called Peter McKeon, to see us. And he immediately got it straight away. And he said, I want to produce this band, you know. And so he did. And we got the deal, and a deal to make a single, actually, not even an album. But he completely understood the songs, or the power of the songs. Not only that, but he understood what he had to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
So we went into a 10-day pre-production period, and where he just basically whipped the songs into shape, you know, where he said, okay, if a guy at a radio station hears Who Can It Be Now, he's not going to wait for 2 minutes before the saxophone hook comes in. You got to put that right up the front of the song. And so we thought, oh, great, brilliant. You know, so you hear this doom, doom, ba ba da da ba ba ba. You're in.
Already.
You're in, right.
Yeah.
So he did things like that. So he basically, you know, made the songs, got rid of all the fat on them, and just kind of, okay, here's essentially what this song is. He did that with Down Under. He did it with Who Can It Be Now. He did it with Overkill and a number of other songs. And that's how we recorded the album. And that's, I think, largely why it was so massively commercially successful.
Yeah. No, very interesting journey for that song, which, and one of the things that you were talking about when you were talking about that song, at how you can take a side road with the song, right?
Yeah.
You can go obviously multiple ways, multiple paths with the same song in terms of how you play it, how you record it, which is a nice little segue in terms of the second song that we're going to be talking about. Because as I said, in the story behind the song, I like hearing the story behind one of the big hits, but also just you as the artist, as the composer, as the writer, as a musician, your favorite song or recording. And you had mentioned to me that Waiting for My Real Life to Begin. And I find it interesting that the side road you took there, and I want to hear it from you, obviously, is that it's released in two different formats on two of your solo albums. So initially you have one version of it, and then in the 2001 album, you have the acoustic stripped down version. But take me through that song, which I think you co-wrote with Tom Mooney. Is that correct? Yeah.
Well, Tom came up with the title, basically.
Okay.
So that's why he's got a piece of it and a credit, because I was working with him at the time up here in house, just messing around. He's a drummer. And we were just messing around with some ideas. And he came over one day with a bunch of donuts and
I love it.
Yeah. And he came into the house. I said, how you doing, Tom? And he goes, you know, I'm just waiting for my real life to begin.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, there you go. And so then, as another interesting thing, where he was having coffee and eating a donut, and I just kind of sat there, and that song just came. That was like a door that got opened. He opened this door. The title just went, that opened the door. And I just wrote the song out. I just wrote that out, and then came up with the chordal structure of it.
So okay,
that was also put together in an hour or something, you know.
That's amazing. So you did not have a structure for that song yet. It was the title, as you said.
There was nothing. It was nothing. He just came in and I said, how are you doing? He said, I'm waiting for my real life to begin. And I thought, that's a great name for a song. And then I just wrote it out. And it became kind of, okay, you know, looking back at it or reading the words back, I thought, well, okay, what is this? And it struck me. I think it's about a lot of things. It's about addiction, and it's about trying to follow the light, you know, instead of the darkness. But we all do this thing where we romanticize the past and dream about the future and think, oh, if only this happens, then I'd be happy. Or if only that had happened, then I wouldn't be in the situation that I'm in now. Or we all look to the future or the past for some kind of salvation or for whether it's happiness or reason or fulfillment. Very rarely do we actually sit where we are and just really, it's a cliche, but very rarely do we just sit and be in the moment and understand that that's really all you have. Mm. So I was sitting around my house in the early 90s because I'd been dropped by MCA Records. And I'd been with large corporate structures for over 10 years. I'd been with Columbia Records and with MCA Records, and I had, you know, big time management, and I had agents, and I had the whole kind of, you know,
machine.
I had that whole thing going.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I didn't have any of it. And it didn't destroy me or anything. I wasn't really upset about it because I wasn't poor, I was hungry, and it was not that I had to go out. I never had to go out and get, okay, I'm going to have to go out and maybe get a job as a waiter or something like that. It wasn't that kind of situation, but it was just like, okay, now how do I negotiate my way forward? And I was thinking about the past, you know, because Men at Work was such a high, it was such a high point, and you think to yourself, oh, you know, you've got to get back there. You want to get back there again because that's really important, or you think it's really important, and you're looking forward and you're thinking, oh, I want to get, you know, this is where I've got to go. So you set goals and all that kind of thing, you know, and so I started to go out on the road and just play small clubs and play to whoever would come along. But I wasn't even really there. I was still thinking, oh, this is an interim thing. This is while I plot and scheme and try and figure out how to get back to the lofty peaks of superstardom, you know, where I belong, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, got to get back to got to be number one again, all those kinds of things.
Very human feeling, yeah. Human condition.
And then I started to, but it's very stressful. And then I started to think, I started to look at the people who would come and see me, whether there was 40 of them or 50 of them or 60 of them, however many people they were. And they were just, they'd gotten up off the sofa and they'd gotten into a car or they'd gotten to where I was playing somehow, and they'd paid their money and they were sitting there and they're going, okay, give me what you got. And so I started to just bring it down to, okay, I'm just going to be here and I'm just going to entertain these people, or I'm going to see what I can do with these people to have an experience together.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then I realized that actually, you know, the universe often has a way of telling you, this is actually what you're supposed to be doing. This is your job. This is your place in the world.
Right, right.
And that's when it started to make sense to me, being in the world and being connected and being okay with not drinking. Because I had a place and I felt connected. I remember sitting out in the backyard one day and just standing up, and my feet were on the ground, and when I stretched up, I could touch the sky. So I felt plugged in. I'm plugged in like it was an electric current, which is really what happens when you perform live. A current takes place where you put it out and it comes back. And if it comes back, it's like it joins up, and then it's just a circular thing. And then you think, right, this is, you know, don't fuck with this. You know, this is working.
Yeah, you're in the zone.
And then you create something that's unrepeatable. You know, it's a unique experience.
Yeah.
And that's why, I mean, people film and stuff all the time now with their phones and they do all that stuff. And, you know, there's nothing you can really do about it unless you, I'm not into saying, oh, okay, give me your phones, all that bullshit, you know. But at the same time, people who do that, they actually miss out on being where they are because they're concerned with, oh, I'll watch this later. How many times have you actually?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right.
You do later, you know. So the live experience is something that it's not for everybody, you know, and it's not a particularly healthy way to live. But I think that that's tied up with that song where about waiting for my real life to begin. Everybody does that. You know, everybody kind of thinks, okay, at some point I'm going to be happy, or at some point I'm going to win, at some point I'm going to make the big score, you know.
Well, and, one of the great lyrics from it that really struck me was the line, forget, and it seems to be exactly what you're talking about, forget about the past, your mask is wearing thin. And yeah. And so about moving forward and all of that, being in the moment, did you, when you were able to do that, did you find your life? So this song, Waiting for My Real Life to Begin. Okay, so you write this song and that lyric and you begin to be more connected, or at least try to be as connected as possible, more in the moment. How would you compare when you were Men at Work and, you know, these massive shows that you had, as this pop band that had these massive hits, and just your own state of mind of happiness, however you define happiness, versus, you know, as you got into your solo work and you became at peace with perhaps some smaller audiences, but nonetheless more just a different path at that point? How do you compare?
Yeah, well, the thing is, well, I don't compare it in a way. I just, I think that's one of the dangers is to compare the past with what you're doing, because they're completely different. And so if you have that as a yardstick, it's dangerous and is kind of a recipe for some kind of insanity, because you probably won't ever happen again. Maybe you have success again. Maybe you have more success. Maybe you have a similar thing might happen. But the thing about the whole Men at Work experience and what it's like with a lot of people who gain success quite quickly is it's the first time. So the first time something happens is always, it's monumental, because it's the first time, you know, you've never experienced it before, you know. I always talk about the fact that before we came to the States, we did a tour of Australia in 81. And it was before we became really successful. And it's like a lot of things which I think is true, and that the happiest moments are the moments that you really remember, that you really relish, are the times where you're almost ready, where you're taking off. You know, if you're taken off in a plane, that's the exciting bit. Once you're up in the air, you go, okay, here we are. You've arrived. You know where? And it's like you do with everything. It's like when you're almost ready is the time when is the most exciting. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that, like, now I kind of try and, you know, I kind of trick myself in a way. Like, if I'm playing somewhere that I've played before, and there's, now, for example, there might be 1,000 people in a room, mm-hmm. if I play solo live, which is to me like a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. It is a lot of people.
Stuff, but it's a lot of people in the room that I have to go, okay, I have to go out there and I have to make these people think at the end of 2 hours, well, that was worth it. That was worth doing, you know, and give them something that they didn't have before.
Yeah.
So I always kind of pretend, or I trick myself into going, this is the first time I've ever done this. This is the first time I've ever played for these people. And so, you still get this little voice on your shoulder before you go on going, who the fuck do you think you are? You know, what, you've got no act. What are you going to say to these people?
Well, and now you have the anticipation, that kind of excitement of, after being in lockdown for all this time, where you're going to start hitting the road again in August, I believe.
Yeah, well, that's another thing that happened, is that when I came off the road, when the pandemic hit, it was kind of shocking because I thought, oh, I don't have to do this tour. Because I'd been touring for 30 years, really. Mm. And more often than not, I was on the road. And it was habit. And I didn't know whether I really loved it. But it was definitely a habit. And you'd have this, you'd put a record together. It's more like a little, like a cottage industry, you know. I've been working with this record label for the last 17 or 18 years. And, you know, you put a record together, maybe takes a year or two, and then you go on the road for the next couple of years, off and on, just working that record. And then you come back and you do the whole thing again. But when the pandemic happened and they said, okay, you just have to go home, it was like this weight had been lifted off my shoulders. And I came home and I thought, oh, I can just be home and not have to go on the road. And so what that meant was that time became this glorious thing where I'd get up and I'd go, oh, today I can just go down to the studio and just mess around. I don't have to think, oh, I've got to get this together because I've got to leave again. So I almost felt guilty about the fact that it was liberating for me. And the other side of the coin, of course, is that, you know, in this country alone, 600,000 people died. So it was this horrendous tragedy, plague of horrendous proportions. And yet I was sitting at home because I could. I didn't have to go out and find some other kind of work. And I was okay financially. And I could be at home and work with ideas and come up with songs and feel pretty good about it.
Yeah. You know? No, well, by the way, it's not an uncommon feeling for a number of people, because obviously for those who weren't directly touched, we were all touched, but directly touched with the most tragic outcomes from this terrible plague. There has been for many, including myself in some ways, there is a certain taking off what you said, kind of expectations you have for yourself for each day and allowing you the kind of the freedom. So as an artist, as a creator, to focus on just a different part of your life rather than having to think about the way that you had thought about life day to day. So it was approaching something completely new because there was no choice, right? And so
exactly. Well, it kind of gave me a sense. I mean, there was a time there where you just didn't really go anywhere. But when you'd get masked up, I'd think, okay, well, I can still go somewhere at some particular time of day. For example, I can go to the beach because I know there's going to be hardly anybody there. You know, so I would go to the beach and just walk on the beach. And so it gave me this sense of wonder that I hadn't really felt for a long, long time. You know, just doing something incredibly simple like that in the middle of this horror, you're just kind of putting yourself in a situation which is just far removed from that. And it's a simplicity, if you like, but it gave me a lot. It gave me a lot of just simple fulfillment, really, in doing the simple things. And we inherited a dog, and so we fell in love with this dog, and so we were just smitten. And I thought to myself, well, this is my new purpose, just to make this guy feel happy.
Hey, that's a good purpose. I have three dogs myself, and they're probably going to jump on me. Exactly. It's wonderful. For any of you out there who's never had a dog, it's a magical experience.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, definitely. So I want to go back to one of the things you said, because when I was asking the questions, like, how did you feel in this part of your life kind of compared to how... I feel completely the same way that you talk about it, which is success is, I'll put it in my words. I won't try to put it in your words. Success is, how do you define success? You know, society defines success in certain kinds of ways, but success, one of the ways I hear you describing it is being in the moment, being present at the moment in whatever circumstances there are. It's not necessarily better or worse. It just is. And if you're able to do that, then you are in the zone, as it were, and the enjoyment of whatever it is, whatever it can be, whether you're on stage, whether you're with your dog walking the beach, is at maximum impact. So
yeah, that's right.
I mean, there's my little philosophical bent.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you can consider yourself successful if you get up in the morning and do whatever the fuck you want.
Well, there's a hell of a lot of freedom in that, and no question. So after this year where there was no choice, really, and so you were fortunate to be in a position where you were able to withstand that, but how do you feel about hitting the road again and getting back into that sort of rhythm? Or do you see your rhythm changing now, forever changed because of your experiences during this lockdown?
Well, I'm starting to, I have to rehearse and practice and learn songs and get all that stuff together. So I've started to do that now, because I'm going on the road in a month. And so, every day I try and, you know, two or three hours of just kind of thinking about that and playing songs, and not only playing songs, but just kind of playing songs in different ways. You know, for example, I went through the set list. I started on the set list the other day, and I started to play songs that I've been playing for 40 years. And I just started to play them in a different way. And I thought, oh, you can play it that way. And because you do something for so long, you just get set in your ways. You think, oh, that's how the song is played. But so often, it doesn't have to be that way. It can be in a different way. So you just kind of, I've just been mulling over things or messing around with songs. And so hopefully by the time it comes around, when you have that three-day rehearsal with the band, which is usually more than enough. Usually after a day, we're good, which is great. It says a lot for the musicians that I work with. But you know, once you go on the road, I think what will happen after two or three days, it'll be like you've never stopped.
Yeah, yeah.
And but I think the difference will be, hopefully, audiences will be up for it because they haven't been out of the house for a year.
They'll be up for it.
And so I have, it'll be a different kind of set list because, you know, as we talked about briefly, during the pandemic, I recorded a lot of songs, actually, maybe 20, over 20 songs. And then I had to pick 10 for a new album. And so that comes out in the new year and it's called Now and the Evermore, that album. And it was originally going to come out this year, but I wasn't sure if I was going to go out on tour. So the record label said to me, well, you know, you're definitely going out on tour next March as solo. So why don't we wait until the new year to put the record out? And I said, because that'll be upon us before we know it. So I said, okay, that's fine. And then, so that was decided. And then I was sitting around the studio and it was sadly one of the days Jerry Marsden had just died from Jerry and the Pacemakers. Mm-hmm. So I started to sing Don't Let the Sun Catch You Crying. And it sounded, you know, I liked it. I thought, oh, that's a nice major seventh chords and stuff. So I just turned the machines on and I recorded that song. And I sent it to my friend Chad Fisher, who's a great composer, musician down in Santa Monica. And I said, see what you can do with this. See if you can orchestrate it. And so he sent it back and it sounded beautiful. And he said, send me another, because he was in between jobs. And he said, send me something else. And so I just started to record some songs which had some kind of meaning to me growing up. So I recorded Waterloo Sunset and I recorded Wichita Lineman and I recorded Can't Find My Way Home and Many Rivers to Cross. So I ended up doing a whole covers album. And so the label really liked it. They said, well, let's put that out in August as an interim record. So that's what we're doing.
So this August, and that's the album, the covers album is called I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. So everybody out there, this August, and well, that's
August
not far 6th, away.
August
6th. August 6th, month and a half from now. And then new music, new recordings, compositions from you in the new year.
Yeah. That album's called Now and the Evermore.
Okay, Now and the Evermore. Great.
So, you know, so consequently, the set list is cool because you can do, because I have a band, and so I can do all the old Men at Work songs, and I can do songs off the solo albums. Then plus some songs off this covers record, and then songs off the new album. So it'll be a very varied set list.
I think that the audiences are all ready to go. I know that I've been buying tickets for the last couple of weeks for the first time in a year because I've been able to. And so a lot of wallets are opening up right now and excited to go out to shows for sure.
Yeah.
Let me just, before we wind things up, and it's fascinating to go through the journey of these songs and your life as an artist and a musician and where you're going from here too, especially as the world is opening up again. But I have to ask, because I'm always curious, who are some, you mentioned some of your favorite artists as you grew up and the most influential, some of them that were influential to you from your earliest of days. Is there any new music or any new artist that you, emerging artists that you see, young artists that you see, who you are especially, I guess, attracted to in terms of the kind of music that they're creating?
Well, there's a lot of good music around. If you're looking for it, you know, I mean, my wife, she listens to Post Malone all the time, and she loves Cardi B, and all the women seem to be doing really well, you know. And I really like all that stuff, you know. Hip hop seems to be really pretty exciting in a lot of ways, and I think it's for a reason. And I can only ever really looking from the outside in, you know. It's not something that I grew up with, but I kind of marvel at it in a lot of ways. And he's not a new artist, but somebody like Snoop, I think to myself, my God, he's a phenomenon, really, in just how he's gone about his life. My father loved him, you know. I used to go back home before my father died, because I think my father was an aspiring, I think he had songs in him, but he just never really. He never really got it together. But I remember going down there and one day, and he goes, hey, do you know that guy, Snoopy Dogg? He's got pigtails. He goes, oh, he's really good, that guy. You know? In the last few years, this has gone back. I'm talking about people who I think will be remembered, you know, for a long, long time. You know, I think as a woman singer and artist, probably Sia is mm-hmm. extraordinary. I mean, I say that I'm biased in a way because I've known her all her life, because I'm not her uncle, but I knew her parents very well.
Ah.
I've known her since she was born, and she actually came to stay with me when I lived in New York in 1987 when she was 11. She said, can I come and stay with you? I go, yeah, sure. So she came for about 6 weeks or something, you know. But anyway, she's an extraordinary talent. And I'm sure there's a lot of others that are not springing to mind.
That's wonderful. And just your advice, as somebody who's been in the business for several years, obviously, what is your advice to young musicians, songwriters, about how they should approach, if they want to have a life as where they can sustain themselves in, whether it's recording or songwriting or touring, whatever, what is your advice to them in this world of music that it is today, which is significantly streaming first, and the business has fundamentally changed from what it was 10 years ago, 20 years, 30 years ago? Do you have any words of wisdom?
I've got words. I don't know whether they're words of wisdom, but and I don't really claim to have ever been totally able to understand the business, the music business. I mean, I still struggle a little bit with it. I understand. I have a good overview of things, but I think that it's important to take care of what is important, and that is really the creative aspect. You know, talking about somebody who's really young and exciting, I mean, you look at Billie Eilish, for example, and her brother. That's a great example of people who have taken care of what's really important. You know, what's really important is what you have to offer. is what you can create and what you can offer the world. That is the thing that you have to polish and take out and keep pure and keep your eye on that and take care of that. And usually what happens is that the other things follow that. You know, how you have that. I mean, you probably have that inner belief anyway, otherwise you wouldn't even embark on it in the first place. But, I mean, you really just have to get on with it. And I always think to myself, well, okay, the smart thing to do is, I don't know whether you really need, like, I haven't had a manager for years because I'm nearly 68 years old. And I think to myself, why, you know, what business is there of me to have somebody looking after me? You know, I mean, that'll come soon enough, you know, when you've got somebody going, you know, taking you into another room, you know. Yeah, it's not something you want to bring on. You know, it's something you want to avoid for as long as possible. But, you know, having a really good legal representative, as dry and cold as it sounds, is really important. Because if you have a really good lawyer, you don't really need anybody else. If you have somebody who can look at contracts, who can just look after that side of things, you know, you're less likely to sign things you shouldn't sign. You're less likely to get into trouble, and then you can kind of take care of the creative aspect of which is really what you should be doing more than anything. But so you really concentrate on that, but you realize that it is a nasty world out there, and there are predators who will fuck with you if they can. So it's good to be able to protect yourself as much as possible.
Yeah, no, great words of wisdom. Obviously, the business has transformed so much, and you know, another area is just that technology is continues to transform it so much. And so, whether you have a lawyer, which I think is great advice, to have somebody who can help you a little bit that way. But musicians, depending on what you want to do, and how far you want to take it, being entrepreneurial is critical, because there are so many different angles now. An angle sounds pejorative, but different ways to reach out and find your audience and build an audience. And so being aware of those kinds of things.
I think that's also part of the modern creativity.
Yeah.
You know, which is different from when I was growing up too. You know, I mean, I think that kids now who are sitting around making music, they factor that in. Okay, I'm going to create this music. What am I going to do with it? They already have some kind of platform that they're going to apply it to, or they have some kind of scene that they're going to expose this, and they have some kind of audience. You know, I think that's part of nowadays. It seems to be more of the creative process.
Yeah. Well, this is great. Listen, Colin, it's wonderful to have you take us through and give us a tour of your musical career, your early days, and through those two wonderful songs of yours. And I urge everybody to, you may know Down Under, and I'm sure most of you know Down Under, and maybe some of you are not aware of the second song we talked about, which is a great song, Waiting for My Real Life to Begin. And one thing I didn't ask you about that, you do have two different versions, at least that I could find, on your main solo albums. Which one do you believe is more faithful to the intent as you wrote the song?
Well, the first one I didn't like much. When I recorded the first one on Topanga, it wasn't fully realized. I didn't really particularly like that version. So that's why I did it again as an acoustic song, and I think that works much better that way. It also works really good now with a band, but it's gone through an evolution, if you like.
Yeah.
And so it works both acoustically and with a band also. But the first version, sometimes you just don't get it right, you know. And then you think, oh well, I'll do it again, because there's no reason why you can't just have another crack at it, you know.
Yeah, it is a very different recording for sure. Yeah. So. Colin, thank you. You've been extremely gracious. You have your upcoming covers album on August 6th. And then early next year, you have your new album. You're going to be hitting the road in August, correct? You're going to be going to various cities. So if you go to Colin's website, you'll be able to see the different tour dates. But great music. Like I said, one of my favorites, another great favorite song is on the Garden State soundtrack. It's a beautiful song. But you have a rich catalog. Great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Nice talking to you.
Yeah. And everybody out there, thanks for joining Story Behind the Song. We'll continue to do this for Consequence and hear more great journeys through these classic songs by talented, iconic artists. Thanks, Colin.
Okay. See you later.
See ya. Enjoy the road.
All right.
Consequence Podcast Network.